Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it to your iPod, iPad, any, you know, I know there are watches you can do this on, but your mobile device that you plug music in, you put your headphones on, you hit play. So today we have an annual show that we've updated that it's real interesting and I'm thrilled to be doing it. For the past 3 years, I've worked with Ron Hedges to offer a top 10 list on the most important cases, or in some cases, legal events. We did it 2008, 9, and 10, and this is now 2011. It's always one of our most downloaded programs, and why mess with success? Well, we have. We're going to continue the format with Ron, you know, talking about the cases and adding his insights. But Ron suggested that we add someone else to the program to have some casual discussion. I think it's a great idea. So we're going to talk about the impacts and trends of the cases, and include in the top 10 list some movements instead of just cases. So for this task, I invited my good friend Kevin Esposito, who, like Ron, is also one of the true pioneers in e-discovery and a participant in the first BNA broadcast I did back in 2006 for the pioneers of e-discovery. He has both a legal and technology background, so he's going to offer a well-rounded perspective. He's also comfortable taking stands on what makes sense, so this show is the opportunity to be both educational, highly entertaining, and possibly controversial. So formerly, Ron Hedges is a six-time presenter now on ESI Bytes, and he trails Judge Grimm now by one show still. Ron served as a United States Magistrate Judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board, participates in the Sedona Working Groups on e-discovery and records, International e-discovery and confidentiality and public access. Ron's also a member of the advisory board of the Advanced E-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of the Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. And among many other publications, he's the author of the Discovery of Electronically Stored Information, Surveying the Legal Landscape from BNA in 2007, and a co-author of Managing Discovery of Electronic Information, A Pocket Guide for Judges, also in 2007. Kevin Esposito has a unique skill set. He's overseen electronic discovery as one of the first technologist lawyers for one of the initial e-discovery serial litigants, Pfizer. And he has an equally strong technology background as a technologist with UPS. His electronic discovery consulting firm, Rivulex, which sounds like Review Less, I know, but provides companies with a way to contract with an electronic discovery expert who's walked in their shoes and can give practical and efficient advice. Our relationship goes back almost 10 years when Kevin first became well-known as a headliner in the e-discovery circles, and his efforts led him to a place of honor as the million-dollar bill in my electronic discovery process modeling game, Discoveryland. Kevin's also a frequent contributor to the e-discovery journal, a widely respected online e-discovery publication authored by independent e-discovery consultants, and is one of the original members of the EDRM group, which provides the e-discovery industry with benchmarks and best practices, as well as the famous EDRM schematic, which describes the e-discovery process in chart form. So with that introduction, let's start the show. And since you're both past guests, it makes less sense to ask how you got started in e-discovery. Let's jump into the topics. The first case that's on the list is the Rimkus decision. And actually, before we start, Ron, I know you were working on this list for other reasons. So why don't you, if you want to mention BNA in the future publication, that would be fine.
Sure. First off, I want to thank you for inviting me again. I'm getting closer and closer to Paul Grimm every day. So that's working well. And with that aside,
can I add one thing, Kevin? You're four behind Judge Grimm, okay? So I don't want you to sweat too much, but
I've got a bit
you're
of
about to be laughed again here. So,
what we're doing today is talking about some developments in the case law and what might happen in the future. And in a sense, this is going to be a precursor to a webinar that I am going to be participating in with BNA in February. So I appreciate being given the opportunity to comment on that, Carl. And if anyone's interested, they can go to the BNA website. We have several programs hopefully coming up later on this year on different aspects of e-discovery.
Great. And Carol Iano is a great friend of mine. I write for her often, used to do her BNA webinars. So that's a good source of e-discovery information. So, all right, with that in mind, let's jump into the first case, the Ramkes decisions, where well-respected Judge Lee Rosenthal from the Fifth Circuit in Texas disagreed somewhat with Judge Shinlin's decision in the Pension Committee, which we talked about on the 2010 list. These cases identify the split between jurisdictions for the standard of care for assessing spoliation when ESI is not preserved and make the fact-based assessment the parties must undertake to determine if a trigger has been activated, requiring a party to initiate a litigation hold. Interesting. So our theme is to talk about the consequences for the parties here. If there was to be a uniform standard for a party to implement a hold based solely on receipt of a summons or complaint. And Ron, why don't you give a little bit of a flavor of both the cases, and then we'll talk about the sort of movement to try to come up with a uniform rule.
Sure. You need to put these cases in the context of the circuits that they came out of. Judge Shinlin's case comes out of the Second Circuit. In the Second Circuit, negligence is sufficient and failure to preserve to warrant not a severe, but a strong remedy. And the remedy could be, for example, an adverse inference instruction. So negligence can be punished. If you go to the Fifth Circuit, where Judge Rosenthal sits, the standard is different, and you have to have willfulness as the level of intent to warrant the imposition of spoliation sanctions. And as you said, Carl, what that means is, as you go across the country to the various circuits, circuits look at different standards of scienter or state of mind for the imposition of sanctions. I think it's fair to say that all the circuits are uniform, that you need to have some degree of prejudice. And obviously, whatever's lost has to be relevant, or let's even say important to the case and not available somewhere else. But the state of mind is where the big distinction is across the country. And I'm not sure where you could go with this in the context of rulemaking, because it's not a procedural question, state of mind. Federal Rules of Civil Procedure address procedure, not substance. It's substantive, which means it would have to go to Congress to really have something done. And I don't know that anyone is interested in having at least this Congress touch any subject involving legal matters if we could avoid it. And as far as receipt of possibly one standard people suggest is receipt of a summons and complaint, the problem there is twofold. Number one, we still don't know what the standard is for the plaintiff, because obviously the plaintiff's duty to preserve is going to arise earlier. Presumably we're still going to have the fact-intensive decision to be made as to when the trigger happened for the plaintiff. Either that, or I suppose we could pick the date of the filing of complaint, which makes no sense because a lot of decisions have been made beforehand. And it's kind of unfair to pick the day when process is served on a party, because often that party knows it's being sued. It's not uncommon for a complaint to be served on a putative defendant and say, hey, before we serve this, settle. So it seems to me, no matter what's done to try to establish some type of uniform standard, there's still going to be need for intensive fact-finding, and there's still going to be situations where it's unfair to allow preservation to start at what we call an official date, as opposed to when someone actually had knowledge of something.
Kevin, you got any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I agree with everything that Ron's put forward already. It's just a question of people saying always, you know, there ought to be a law. People hear about any kind of an abuse or any kind of a problem, and they start, you know, reaching for some sort of a standard that they can hang their hat on because it makes people feel better. But with all standards, the devil's in the details. You know, we don't deal with clear-cut information in most of our cases, and our system of law is highly facts, you know, specific, as Ron's already pointed out. it makes it hard to establish any standard based upon an arbitrary point in time. Receipt of a complaint is one thing, but determining precisely what information is required is another. I spend an awful lot of time with defense clients and their legal teams, and very rarely do the plaintiffs even know what information they need at the start of the matter. There's an allegation and a request to have that allegation heard, but even the plaintiffs feel that they need time to better develop an understanding of what transpired and who's got what information. I think we have some guidelines already in case law that do a great job of providing a flexible standard with an emphasis on fair dealing, technical competence, and good corporate citizenship. Those guidelines are applied to the specific facts of any case, and then you figure out how to move forward. I think that's still the best approach, and any attempt to oppose a set routine is going to be counterproductive. I do think, though, that what gets lost a lot is the fact that the cases that you hear about along these lines, and the ones that I know of throughout e-discovery history, whether you're talking about cases from just after 2000 or right up to Rimkus and Naco v. Lilly that was heard last year in Tennessee, I think all these cases are dealing with situations where there is glaring omissions or failures to act. I think we've already got de facto standards of conduct for what needs to be done, and having some sort of an arbitrary uniform standard wouldn't have made any difference in those cases and probably won't make a difference in others. Why add another rule to the mix?
Yeah, and I just think it's one big conspiracy. It's something for to move the analysis away from search and retrieval and machine-assisted review, which takes a little understanding of vector spaces and how these machines work, just a little bit of understanding, versus something that everyone can all lawyers can have an opinion on. But anyway, that's a joke. It is an important rule, but it's out there, and it's like the cloud over the other issue that I'm interested in. But anyway, all right, let's move to the next one. Manyard versus the United States, which is the latest privacy case hitting the Supreme Court after last year's Kwan decision, which also made the 2010 top 10 list. Assuming the Supreme Court affirms the D.C. Circuit, which recognizes a privacy interest in an individual's car movements over time, what might be the next technology to fall under scrutiny? And Ron, before we start, you want to sort of summarize Manyard versus United States, then I'll ask Kevin what his thoughts are.
Sure. The police suspected some individuals of being involved in illicit activity, illegal activity, went to a driveway, surreptitiously put a GPS device on a car, and use that GPS device to track the movements of its individuals for almost a month. And at the end of it, they had whatever they needed to have to make an arrest of someone. And the argument made is everything involving the GPS really should be thrown out and not used because you needed probable cause under the Fourth Amendment, and this is a Fourth Amendment case because it was in the District of Columbia. You needed a search warrant to be able to do that. There was no search warrant. There was no showing of probable cause. And I think it's fair to say now, Carl, that the country is totally split in cases as to whether or not tracking like this is or is not something that falls within the probable cause requirement of the Fourth Amendment.
And Kevin, what's your thought on this? And let's talk about traffic cameras a little bit or get that into your answer, because I think that's the obvious technology that people might be concerned about.
Well, I think the traffic cameras are the obvious one. People talk about traffic cameras. They talk about the Garmin GPSs and TomToms that are all out there. They talk about the use of the Easy Pass or the Fast Pass for people who are in the Northeast. There's a number of technologies out there. Traffic cams are probably getting a lot of the play because they're the most obvious. The UK did a lot of work after the London bombings with their CCTV network, and that highlighted the big brother factor for a lot of people. GPS is something that you physically carry with you, and you realize that when you're carrying it, you're in contact with the satellite, and if you can see them, they can see you. But there's other technologies to think about as well. Lots of times people just don't think about the things you're using every day. Lots of the devices that you're using, from phones to your car radio to your smartphone, keeps track of your movements automatically. So what about all of those? every one of those is in contact with an organization that's trying to sell you something, or information is going to be offered to you as to a place to go to eat or to visit or something. So we don't think about those. You know, we might, because we get this information and it's helpful information, we get it on the fly, we don't think about it all that much. But, you know, we might think differently if we thought that our iPhones had gone to the dark side and they were snitching on us. It's a completely different situation. You know, Carl, you know I often teach using pop culture as a medium. And we all know from watching shows like Person of Interest and CSI that the first thing you need to do when you want to disappear is you lose your cell phone and you pull the SIM chip, right? So people know that about cell phones, but they don't think about all the other handheld devices that they're using. And each of those handheld devices could potentially track their movements. People use Wi-Fi. They use DirecTV when they travel. They're watching TV as they're going along on the train or something. And they use iPads for everything from, you know, booking getaway plane tickets to moving money offshore and online banking. You know, I'm kidding around, of course, but there's a lot of activities out there that are facilitated by technology. So, you know, I'm just waiting for the TV episode where a gang member is tracked down because they pinpointed where he downloaded a rap song from iTunes. I've heard similar stories about how people have been located on various issues. I don't think you've seen case law on it yet, but it's only a matter of time. You know, or someone's going to have a laptop or a netbook under their arm and their location is going to be triangulated because they opened it up at McDonald's. You know, you can see it now where Jim Brass says, "Hey, great work, you guys." And Ted Danson replies, "Nah, it wasn't us. He was trapped by his love of the McRib." You know, every device that you've got uses a chip or a radio wave or uses a bit of a tracking system. And all of those things chip away a little bit more at the armor that we thought we had as to where we are and what we're doing. So, you know, smartphones, iPads, GPS units, and, you know, whatever else Apple decides to devise over the next 2 or 3 years, all these things are going to be things we need to consider, and we're probably going to have to, you know, come up with adequate defenses to make sure that there are not abuses either in their use or in using the information that can be gathered by other organizations looking in on tracking records.
Yeah, I love the answer. My only thought on it is that a lot of it depends on how much closer lawyers become to technologists, because a lot of those things that you're talking about, the stretches between the device and the evidence, requires someone with a technological sense of we should look here, we could look there, to be helping. And I'm writing an article on this I've just finished on sort of the barriers to using technology and some of the issues that you know lawyers that aren't comfortable with technology are causing. But Ron, do you have any thoughts on this?
I expect what we're going to be seeing. Well, first, having heard some of the argument from the Supreme Court through other people, I don't know that we should necessarily expect a major constitutional decision here. It seems to me that if the justices want to avoid addressing electronic issues, and certainly they said that in Quad, there is a way to avoid it by saying the police entered on into the curtilage of a home or property and should not have done that. Now, this is not curtilage as we understand it, but there's a way for the Supreme Court to get out of making a far-reaching decision. The other thing I think we need to focus on, and Kevin's really pointed this out, is that really what that court is talking about is not a snapshot of a person, I don't think, but tracking someone over time. And the cases all seem to suggest that we're not concerned about locating a person at a particular time. We're concerned at following him around because that implicates privacy issues. That concerns me, because if that's going to be challenged by the Supreme Court, that's an argument that was made years ago and helped support the constitutional right to abortion. So I think we're opening a giant can of worms with privacy, how this decision goes one way or the other. The other comment I'd make is there are TV cameras everywhere. Most of those cameras are there, obviously, for crime, so they're working continuously. But think of a camera at a traffic stop where it just flashes out if a car runs a red light. Now, one car running a red light at one point doesn't seem to implicate privacy rights other than saying I was on the road one day at one spot. So I think there's a lot of nuances that may come out of this decision. And Kevin talks about just how expansive we are with electronics these days and what are the implications of it. So I think, however Maynard is decided, and I don't know if we'll get a decision for the end of term, who knows. People are going to be picking at it for a long time and trying to see what they do with it. The other comment I'd make, though, and picking up on something Kevin said, we're really talking about government monitoring here. But if you have all these different technologies and the like, and you're being investigated by your employer or a spouse or something, the calculus is going to change again there. So I think we're in for a lot of adventure in the world of privacy and movement in the course of the next few years.
It should make for some interesting ESI Byte shows. And I would also add that, the automatic camcorder on the police car is another example, and that might infringe on the privacy rights of the police officer. You know, ask Rodney King about that one. So I guess it can cut both ways. Technology giveth and it taketh away. So the third issue that we're going to talk about here also impacts preservation, which we talked about in the first point. And if you're looking at Pippins versus KPMG, the accounting consulting firm, and the facts in that case with a twist would be something we would consider. So assume that an individual or an entity, both the plaintiff and the defendant, can exercise proportionality decisions before the commencement of a civil action. And we got to assume that their decisions are going to be a reasonable one. What specific factors should lead the decision-making on what can be held and what can be handled subject to a company's normal data retention policy? And Ron, can you start out by summarizing the facts of this case, and then we can talk about the sort of, you know, under the kimono, what both sides are doing issue?
Well, it's a little difficult to talk about the facts of the case because everyone is focusing on not how much information KPMG had to keep. And this was a possible labor case where there might have been an obligation on the part of KPMG to keep an enormous amount of ESI on an enormous number of individuals, and there really were fights between the parties as to what volume should be kept or not. The case I think is really getting incredible amount of play is because some dicta in it from the magistrate judge, who said more or less proportionality doesn't figure into preservation, at least early. And I think, I don't know how many of you have seen it, but it is up on appeal. There's been one amicus brief sent in. There's been responding briefs in now. And I can't remember the district judge who has it. But I think you can't avoid getting into some discussion of proportionality when you preserve. But maybe it's along the line Kevin was talking about, that even if you're a plaintiff and you've got to decide what you're going to keep, you can't anticipate things that the other side may or may not do unless you already know about them. And why do you preserve information for causes of action you don't know you have yet or the like? So maybe proportionality really enters into those initial decisions under the thought of reasonableness, because we all say, and courts say, you need to be reasonable in deciding what you're going to preserve or not. But then, of course, that comes to the problem, depending where you are. If you're not reasonable, that means you're negligent. You can be penalized for it, as happened to parties in Judge Shindlin's decision in New York. So I'm kind of on the air on this one. With KPMG, KPMG knows it's going to be in the equivalent of a class action, and a class action in that matter. You'd think that if you may be in a class action, you need to preserve pretty broadly because you could have thousands of class members. On the other hand, the cost of doing that and the need to do that, especially if, for example, a class hadn't been certified yet, makes you wonder about what kind of decisions you need to make and how often you could ever be right when you're making these decisions unilaterally. And there's an opportunity to talk to the other side all the time in these, and I wonder if that didn't enter into part of the calculus too here.
Well, Kevin, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I agree with Ron. I need to move away from the facts of the case a little bit, only because when I pulled it up and I was looking at Pippin's, you look at some of the information in there, and as a person who works in this area, sometimes I was either scratching my head or saying, what? What are they talking about? Some of the claims that were made as far as the difficulties and the costs that are involved, I don't want to you know, denigrate anyone's work or minimize anyone's burdens, but you know, for some of the facts, I was just kind of saying, I've got to suspend some disbelief a little bit here. And so, again, moving to the dicta, I see that that's more important per se because, you know, the statement that proportionality doesn't come into play at the very beginning really goes against everything that I've experienced in the past 12, 13 years of e-discovery. You know, maybe from an official standpoint or trying to state a bright line rule, you might say that, but from what I've seen, there's usually a lot more negotiation or de facto sort of proportionality that comes in there. You know, I'm not going to say that I think there's anything that needs to be suggested that differs from current practice. You know, most of the debates that I get involved with are when people are being asked to keep all kinds of data that's only remotely, if at all, related to a matter. You know, the question then becomes, is it reasonable to ask someone to keep backup tapes of a finance system if you're working on a slip and fall case? And people say, oh, that's ridiculous. That's quite obvious. Well, maybe it's not. On the other hand, is it reasonable to claim that emails never contain business records? I mean, these are some of the things that we've heard over the years. And, you know, one of the things that Ron used to say when he was on the bench was that people forget the part of the analysis that determines whether the information requested relates to a claim or defense of the matter at hand. So people have to do a lot of analysis internally as far as, well, what is the case about and what are we looking to do? And, you know, we still have a professional and ethical obligation to see that that analysis is completed and that we work with our clients to the best of our abilities. Preservation is probably the biggest defense shield that you can have. Yes, it's complicated, and yes, it's expensive, but if you do an excellent job at preservation, later on that can pay dividends. And yes, we're still going to have the situation where we as lawyers are the bearers of bad news. We go to talk to the IT people about, you know, well, I need you to pull all these hard drives, or I need you to keep your backups, or I need you to suspend deleting information out of databases. And, you know, the finance people are never going to be happy with this because we're going to be impacting what they're doing, and the support costs of helping the preservations are going to be, you know, up there. But, you know, that's a job we've signed up for. And we need to take a look at how we work with our clients to get a very aggressive discussion going. You know, the communication factor is critical, making sure that we're getting down to the key areas and key issues. You know, to say that you have to keep 500,000 hard drives, you know, there's probably other ways of doing it than pulling a physical drive. If you want to keep information, you know, you need to get facile in doing different types of preservation and working with people to coordinate those efforts. A lot of this is going to require us to be able to speak knowledgeably about what is in the information out there, why does it relate to a specific claim or defense. And, you know, why is it that we feel either you have to tell your client, yes, this is the kind of thing I need, think you need to hold on to, or be able to go back to the judge or the other side and say, look, this is the information I'm not keeping because I think this is not relevant. I mean, that was one of the things that was specifically called out in the Pippin's case, was that they had failed to show why the information was not relevant. And you might say, well, it's perfectly obvious. You know, a complete hard drive is going to contain all kinds of stuff, but they never even made the argument. So they didn't even have a chance to get to that point. So it takes a lot of work on our side, but, you know, I think that the guidelines are already out there.
Yeah, I agree. Although I liked one of the things you mentioned there about e-disclosure is basically, I'll paraphrase it, is that, you know, as a party on one side looking at a case, you have a sort of an understanding of what, if you look at the complaint and the various pleadings, what the other side's looking for. And, you know, as long as you're documenting what you're doing, you know, all comes down to, you know, risk assessment. And, I mean, you can't be perfect. You're just trying to, you know, grab and preserve what logically relates to the case. If it's a small matter, just document your decision making. Let the court decide later on what's reasonable. I think this preserving everything shows a lack of intestinal fortitude on behalf of many companies. And you know, maybe it's easy when you're in a small company to say this, but
well, there's an undercurrent running through this though, and I think as we go forward, we're going to see it more and more in a corporate setting. And Kevin, you can correct me, if I'm wrong, but my sense now is, number one, a lot of corporations, and by the way, more than corporations, government agencies, anyone who's an organization as opposed to an individual, is starting to get so many more mobile sources of ESI that it's going to have to deal with.
Yeah.
It's getting pretty hard to figure out who has what and to separate everything. So I think that's going to make the preservation task a little difficult in the future unless you start seeing robust records retention policies that organizations have and that they enforce and they monitor. So we may be seeing more issues in the future as to, you know, this guy did all his work on his cell phone and where are the records and this and that. And tell me how you think that might shape out.
I look at it like brain injuries. Okay, you know, everyone's concerned that, you know, you have you got rid of all the email, you know, in the past. Okay, it's gone now. Backup tape's gone. The email's gone. But now there's so many different paths of connecting that, you know, if you're creative, there might be more and more ways to get to what you need to make your case if you're on one side, because it's going to be really hard to say you got rid of everything. With all the multiple sources of information that's out there that's created.
Yeah, I don't think it's just the issue of getting rid of stuff or even connecting the dots. I think to what Ron was talking about, the use of personal devices and the ubiquitousness of data that's out there, a lot of my clients are having battles between their business people and their IT people, and a lot of times we need to try to mediate those discussions because the IT people are trying to be very helpful. And for every device that's out there, people will say, well, why can't I use it? Email was originally forced in because people wanted to use email to, you know, send information to their AOL contacts or whatever else in the sun. Same thing with instant messaging. People weren't instant messaging necessarily business partners. They wanted to know when Billy got home from school or the wife to send a note saying bring home some milk and eggs or something of that nature. So it's desire to have that personal interaction that drives additional technologies out there. So in the past, where an organization might have said, look, you can only use a laptop computer if we provide it, or you can only use a smartphone if we provide it, people are coming in saying, I don't want to carry two or three cell phones. You know, Carl, you were the one that was kidding me because you said it looked like Batman because I had a utility belt with two or three cell phones and beepers and everything else. You know, people don't want that. They want a single device. So if they've got a single device, whether it's an iPhone or an iPad or, you know, any other BlackBerry or other kind of smartphone that's out there, people want to use their device. They don't want to have to carry a personal device and a business device because it's Monday through Friday. So that causes a problem because there's a tendency for people then to be either sharing information over their personal device or demanding to use a personal device to work with corporate information. And then you've lost control of it because then the person's got their iPhone and they've downloaded something from their corporate servers and it's synced up to the cloud and it's backed up with all their personal stuff as well. So you're beginning to lose control of the corporate records. And what Ron mentioned about the record retention schedules and record management programs is very important because since we know this is going to be an issue, we can't turn a blind eye. We can see this is a trend. We can see this is happening. So I'm waiting for the day where someone's called into court and they're told, you know, when you knew that all of your people were going to be using these personal devices, that was the day that you had effective notice that you needed to come up with a contingency plan. So don't come to me now and say, oh, I can't give you all those records, or oh, I don't have the financial information because it's scattered on 7,000 devices across the city of New York. No, you've got to provide an alternative. You should have seen that coming. You should have seen that was going to become a need. And by the way, there's this little thing called your corporate record retention schedule that reminds you of your duties to keep records for specific periods of time. So just because the technology has changed, you chose to use that technology, you know, you're on the hook for this. So I think this is going to be something we're going to hear more and more about. I know there's a lot of organizations that are out there either amending retention schedules in order to have specific classifications for mobile data or things of that nature. And there's a lot of data security people within IT that are very, very concerned as to where the intellectual property of organizations is going to. So, you know, as these things expand, we're going to continue to hear more.
We're getting sucked in the mobile data, and this podcast will be about that. We'll have to pick up the pace a little bit here, although I will say that there's something to be said about the basic statement that technologists aren't necessarily fashion mavens. So, Kevin, you said it yourself with your Batman belt. But our next two topics deal with the actual or possible conflict of interest between the attorney and the client over spoliation by the client, when the attorney did everything right, as in the United Central Bank versus Canaan Fashions Inc. case. You know, if an actual conflict arises, the attorneys will presumably withdraw or seek to leave. And, you know, we want to talk about, is there a reasonable alternative to the solution of withdrawing? And first, Ron, can you summarize the facts of this case?
United Central is out of Illinois, if I recall. It's fascinating because eventually what happened to a server that had information on it that was relevant, the server was, oh, you can say, surreptitiously sold or whatever, and wound up in, I believe, Dubai. Information was lost, there was spoliation, and the other side moves to sanction for spoliation, the defendant and the lawyer. And it goes before a magistrate judge. The magistrate judge has no problem sanctioning the defendant itself, the party, because of what it did. But the interesting part is the magistrate judge said, you know, I'm not going to impose sanctions on the lawyers. They did everything they could do. They told their client to institute a hold. They sent out a legal hold notice. They were given assurances by the client that the hold notice was being complied with and the like. And the judge said, that's it. There's no reason to sanction them. And it went up to the district court, and the failure of the magistrate judge, the decision of the magistrate judge not to sanction the attorney, never even went up on appeal. So it was really an issue of the client at that stage. But it's fascinating that you raise this, Carl, because I was at a program last week, and some people said, you know, corporations are bringing more and more work in-house these days.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me, and I mentioned this at the program, that sounds like there's going to be an opportunity there for the other side to say, the lawyer just failed to do what the lawyer should have done, and the lawyer should be sanctioned, and you just can't rely on your client to do all this work. So I don't know whether that's going to be an expansion or not, but it seems to me, as more and more things go in-house, there's more and more of a possibility that something can go wrong. And that's, for example, what happened when the Qualcomm decisions came out in California, where the attorney and the client wound up just pointing fingers basically at each other.
Well, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, Kevin, and we can sort of combine these two, because the next one, you know, this first one deals with the ability, you know, whether the attorney should withdraw if they see a conflict. But you know, you've sort of combined it, Ron, with what our fifth point was what type of due diligence do you have to do?
I'm trying to move us along.
Yeah, so I'll ask Kevin what your thoughts are on both these as well.
Well, I think that to one point that Ron had raised, there was a big pushback when we first began bringing legal work in-house. There was a very big pushback, and one of the first objections we got from the outside law firms was, well, I can't let you do this work because I can't rely on what you do. And I can tell you that that's a non-starter with the corporate clients. I understand that there's a need for the lawyers to get more involved and for people to work more closely with perhaps their corporate clients that are beginning to do work in-house. I think that's an obligation for them to help to build a team. You know, in this particular case, there was a sale of some locations, and they had a server sitting there, and they just conveniently left the server there as other people took over the building. More and more, as I work with law firms, we find that you really need to find out what your clients are doing in terms of their mergers, acquisitions, and divestitures. You have to be more closely tied into what it is that they're doing, and you have to build a relationship with the IT people to know what they're doing. So the IT people very often will say, hey, what about this server over here, or you know, what about this email batch that we have, or how are we going to reconstruct things? And they're going to be asking those questions. And one of the things I learned a long time ago at UPS, actually, was the concept of go look. If you're going to sit in your office and hope that everyone's going to bring relevant information to you, warts and all, you're dreaming. You've got to get out and talk to people. You can't be like the guy on Charlie's Angels where he's just a voice over a speakerphone that says, you know, hey, go do this, that, and the other thing. Go collect your information, go process it, and let me know what you've got. You've got to show up. You've got to talk to people. You've got to build those teams. And it's going to be critical as we move further down this path that if attorneys are going to become more of an advisor than a doer of these services, they've got to be able to have the inside information as to how these things were done. And you can't get that information by sitting in your office. You've got to be out there with your client, and you know, if someone's doing collection, participate in the collection. If someone's doing processing and the review, you've got to have a finger in there. You've got to be discussing with people how that's being handled. And it's by building that information that you're going to be in a better position to rely on what your client's done because you've done it together. If you continue to do it in a siloed fashion where, you know, I'm not going to rely on this because you did it, the clients aren't going to be happy with you, and you're never going to be in a position where you feel comfortable when you're walking into court.
And it's interesting with that, Carl, because what Kevin says to some degree is going to have to do, depending on your jurisdiction, if you're a lawyer, whether you can make a quiet withdrawal or a noisy withdrawal. And the noisy withdrawal is you have to basically rat somebody out, which lawyers intuitively aren't going to do. And that's usually very, very limited in cases of real hazards to public safety and the like. And again, that depends on the state that you're barred in. But I expect it's going to create a lot of tension at the beginning, unless, Kevin, what you're really suggesting is when you're establishing these relationships, the relationship's got to be a long-standing one between, say, one firm or a group of firms and a corporation, so you don't have to go back and start the learning curve all over again.
Yeah, the challenge you have there is you're also fighting trends to some extent. I mean, it used to be you'd have the law firm that represented the corporation for the last 80 years, 90 years, and in large corporate situations. The first large corporations aren't always around forever, like they seem to have been for 30, 40 years. But the other thing is the relationship between outside and in-house, counsel has changed with a lot more management and a lot more threat of replacing. You look at all the ACCA surveys and over half of the in-house people terminated relationship with the law firm and hired a new one. So I think Kevin's go look is probably the best approach in this world where you do have some fluidity between service providers.
Well, but now think of the other side of that. If the law firm goes to Kevin and say, hey, I want to look at all this, I think one of Kevin's responses might be, you know, I'm not paying you to come in and look. I'm paying you to go represent me in court, and I'll take care of this. And we've seen that now because of concerns about law firms' billings and other concerns about corporations saying we don't want to pay to educate first-year associates and the like. So I think we may be seeing some tension for a while in this.
No one said it was going to be easy, and I wasn't saying go look with me and my three associates.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things here is, again, the question of proportionality. I think more and more people are working, and I get your point, Ron, and I know why people might push back and say, I'm not going to show all this stuff to you, or don't worry about it, I've got it covered. But I always tell people on both sides, tell the law firms that we work with and the clients that we work with, if a person is secure in their knowledge, they're not going to object to any questions you might put up. You know, if they really know what they're doing and if they're confident that they're doing it in the proper way, they should have no trouble with you asking specific questions about specific issues or asking to see how your process was developed or the documentation that covered that process. That's all standard information they should be more than willing to share. If someone pushes back on a law firm and says, I don't want you to see this, that's where my red flags would go up. I would have no problem with that. And I tell corporate clients that too. Don't think you're going to stonewall them either. You need to share. So, you know, we need to work together on this stuff. We can't have an adversarial relationship with the clients as well as the other side.
Yep. Well, the next topic involves the always sensitive topic of technology replacing people. In the case at hand, Gortmuller versus International Furniture Marketing, Inc., it resulted in a holding that the replacement of an older employee by a computer program did not constitute age discrimination. What might this ruling lead to as we proceed into the computer age is something to think about. Especially relevant is the review area for lawyers, given the potential to reduce review with machine-assisted review. And Kevin, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I think the issue of people being replaced by technology has been a fear since the Industrial Revolution. You know, ever since you took people out of the fields and replaced them with tractors, people got upset. And I think there's going to be a realignment of attorneys as a result of technology, but I don't see them being replaced. You know, as proof of this, I'm going to set the Wayback Machine to the 1960s a little bit and talk about Star Trek, which will be great for all the IT people on the line. You know, it's a great example of an authoritative figure being replaced by technology there when Captain Kirk was replaced by the M5 computer. I don't know if you remember that. That episode was called The Ultimate Computer. And he was derided a bit because he was supposed to have been turned into a duncel, a part that serves no purpose, because this great computer was going to come and run everything for the Federation instead. And, you know, the reason M5 failed is the same reason that computer systems fail in our legal world as well. The practice of law has to take into consideration human actions, human emotions, human behavior, human nature. You know, we might try with heuristics and algorithms to put together a computer, but I really don't think they're going to create a computer system that can truly understand the human side of what we do. You know, if you're looking for evidence that someone's done something wrong and you put in the phrase that says Bob Jones is a turkey, that's probably not going to rate very highly on the various search indexes that are out there in these various tools. But if you then are told by somebody on the line that Bob Jones just happened to have been the engineer who was responsible for inspecting everything, that's going to change things. So as both a technologist and a lawyer, I think it's clear that there's a role for automation to help to eliminate rote work. But I don't think we have to worry about robots doing our jobs for us. But with the International Furniture case, I'm sure that there's going to be more causes of action that come up as we see how the rights of individuals can be impacted technology, and I think that's a good thing. You know, as with the tale of M5, we never can lose sight of the fact that the use of technology can have unintended consequences. So, you know, make use of the technology, but make sure that nothing goes wrong.
I'm just picturing you, Kevin, in a Klingon outfit at some convention. I'm sure we won't go there, but you know, my I'll just weigh in 2 cents on the computers replacing people. If you know, no one has come up with a uniform description of what review world means. You know, is it predictive coding? Is it machine assisted review? Is it technology assisted review? You know, people throw out different things. The key word in there is assisted, you know, on the last two, which I like better. You know, the tools won't do it without the people. And, you know, but together they work a lot better. Anyway, that's 2 cents on that issue. Ron, do you have anything you want to add on the case?
No, I think my friend has said everything we need to say about this.
All right.
Other than to say that we're going to be seeing it more and more. And the question, I suppose, at some point is when or how is the EEOC going to be involved? Now, they're in charge of enforcing equal employment laws and the like. And what position are they going to take when we see more of these things?
You don't see it offshore.
I
took a trip through India, and they were building an 8-lane highway by hand, literally in 105-degree weather with a couple machines. But when you have billions of people, your people are your resource. But anyway, that has nothing
to do with... Things will be changing, but we don't know how it will change.
That's true. Well, I'm going to let you lead on the next one then, Ron. This is, I think, a great case, and I know there was a lot of conversation at this at Georgetown recently, and at another conference I saw you speak at. This is a particularly scary case with ethical implications. Is In Re Taylor, which is a Third Circuit decision that affirms sanctions against a lawyer, spoke of competence as encompassing some knowledge of computer systems used to generate what would be offered in evidence, but essentially said that an attorney need not know everything. So what should an attorney know about computers and computer-generated evidence these days? Are we going to need experts to testify about computer-generated information? Is there a doll bearer implication here?
It's going to be fascinating how all this is going to turn out now, I think, because the Taylor decision arose in the context where an attorney is representing a lending institution, and the lending institution wants to foreclose on a mortgage, and that institution uses a third party to generate computer information that's used by the lawyer in court. And the problem was there was a fundamental problem with the information. It didn't pick up a legitimate dispute that the homeowner had with the lender. And that led the bankruptcy judge to impose sanctions. It's interesting, the sanctions are under the bankruptcy equivalent of Rule 11. It's under Rule 9011. And that had to do with the certifications that the lawyer made. And the judge said, look, these certifications are wrong. You can't just rely on things you get from a computer. You have to know something. And now the implications of that could be profound, especially when you're trying to move something to evidence. But think about when you're serving discovery requests and responses and doing pleadings, you're relying on computer information. What are you doing so you can actually say, hey, I have personal knowledge of this? And so I think we're obviously going to be seeing more and more of that as we go forward. And as far as what you should know, I guess you should know enough to be able to talk to someone who generated that list and say, is everything in here? Is there anything missing? Especially now, if you're in the mortgage industry or working for a mortgagee, the next thing you're going to have to ask is, are there any disputes or whatever that this isn't picked up and the like? And the ABA is going through this too, Carl, because the ABA is working on Ethics 2020, where there isn't an intent, at least as now, to actually change the model rules of professional conduct. But there is to add and change the comments to the model rules to take into account the lawyer's need for competence in the area. So I think we're going to be demanding more competence of lawyers. I think courts will. And I think adversaries will. And the other interesting issue, of course, as you say, is other than what's the attorney supposed to do, the next question, of course, is how far are you supposed to go doing it? You know, the Third Circuit went out of its way to say, we are not trying to impose this major requirement on you, lawyer, but you need to know something. So I think we're up in the air with that. And the Daubert issues are going to be fascinating, too, I think, as we go forward. Presumably, if you're in the discovery stage, you don't need an expert. You can just have affidavits and the like that come in. But if we're getting into disputes about programming and databases and the like, certainly at the time of trial there are going to be Daubert issues and need for a Daubert qualified expert. But I wonder if we're going to start crossing the line as we go into discovery, and we have so many issues coming up that are beyond the competence of attorneys and judges.
Kevin, you have any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting for me, especially since I've been both in the technology area and the legal area, because it almost seems like we forget everything we ever learned just because a computer becomes involved. You know, I think the need for experts is honestly going to decrease over time, because I think that people of our generation and the people that came before us are maybe not as comfortable with technology as the people that are our children and grandchildren, you know. So I think people are going to know a lot more naturally about these devices. I mean, you know, we use experts in other disciplines, accountants, engineers, accident reconstructionists. You know, we use them when we need to use them. But for the most part, that's for very specialized information. I've dealt with a lot of lawyers who will walk into an organization, and if they're finance guys, then they're going to come in and explain how the lawyers understand how a hedge fund works. If they're engineers, then the lawyer's going to come in and say, how I understand all the issues related to what you do as an engineer. And yet, when they start talking about computer systems, they shut down. They say, well, I don't know anything about that. That's a computer, and I don't know anything about it. You know, what do you need to know from my standpoint, working on both sides? I think you need to know what are the key applications that are used in your client's industry so that you know if you're dealing with a run-of-the-mill system or something more esoteric. You know, if you've got off-the-shelf software, you're going to have a lot less issues than if you've got something that your client has written on their own. I think you need to know about alternative ways of preserving data, like we talked about earlier in the call. You know, I think aside from that, you don't need to be an expert yourself, but you need to know where to go to get the information if you need it. I don't think anyone can just sit back and say, well, that's not my job or that's not my area. I think you need to know when you're dealing with run-of-the-mill information and when you're dealing with unique information. And I agree with Ron, you have to have enough of an understanding on the information so that if your red flags are raised, you're able to push back a little and say, well, but where did this information come from? Are you sure there was no changing to it? And do you have an audit trail for it so I know who changed it at a particular point in time? You don't have to be an expert. You do have to be educated.
Yeah, and I'm going to throw out two quick points. One's a plug. I'm doing a podcast in January with both Judge Peck and Judge Moss and maybe one other judge I'm thinking about how these newer search and retrieval approaches will be assessed. Judge Peck's written about this. Judge Moss has talked on webinars about this. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the judges on that panel talked about not a Daubert analysis, but simply this is discovery and you come into court and we'll talk about it. You know, we'll try to, you know, flesh it out. But the other thing I want to throw out on, in terms of understanding, I agree with Kevin completely, understanding the differences between the search, because right now everyone looks at machine-assisted review as being the same, and it's not. The goal is to train your technology on a seed set to then replicate across the rest of the rest of the population of documents. But all the tools get there different ways. Some require people to train the set by looking at a large number of documents, and then you hit the button and predict. Other tools rely on random samples across the population of documents, and other tools rely on algorithms to learn from what you've already coded to find more. And so to lump, this area is the same shows not trying to understand a little bit about the differences about the approaches. But I think over time that need to really understand will be more comfortable.
Carl, I think we're talking broader than just search, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Third Circuit decision was not at all about search. So I think you're right that you've got to be able to understand any kind of technology that's being used to generate information or evidence in a court. And I also think you're right. We don't need Daubert qualified experts to come in for discovery issues and the like. But I'm not as sanguine as Kevin is that we're going to be educated enough in the near future that this issue is going to drop down a little.
Okay, well, let's go to the next topic, which is we touched on earlier, data privacy. It's obvious it's growing given the earlier discussion. But in the United States, we don't have anything as comprehensive as the European Union with its data privacy directive. Instead, the U.S. has state and federal laws that address specific topics such as data breach and personal health information. Assume that Congress is considering a comprehensive approach to data privacy that would preempt state laws. What should the congressional approach be, if any? Do you want to jump in on this, Ron?
Sure. There are so many hurdles to Congress doing anything that we see every day. Certainly makes this come into the world of science fiction or speculation, but put that aside. I would hope if Congress ever got into this area that it would perhaps more than anything else, do something about the concept of data aggregation. That bothers me a lot, that information, for example, that I might have the drug company can be aggregated under current laws and sold for different reasons, just like medical information would. I suppose what I would be primarily concerned about is information about me as a person, about my health, about my preferences and things, as opposed to movement, because I quite frankly think that ship has sailed a long time ago, about you being anywhere where you honestly think you can have any privacy in your location, just for the reason Kevin mentioned before, that we all carry all these devices around that do everything. So I would hope we would do something at a national level to protect really personal information, and probably personal information more refined than Europe does. I think Europe comes from a very different background than we on the misuse of personal information. And then the other thing I think I'd like to see is some kind of uniformity in a data breach law, because the rules are all over the place on that. We have California's got a data breach law. Massachusetts has a strong one. There are supposedly some federal runs, but none of them have teeth in a way. So I suppose I would be concerned about, yeah, real personal information to me, private personal information, and doing something about data breach.
Kevin, you have anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I think I would agree on the focus on personal information. And I think also that the other laws that they might look towards, whether it's the UK data privacy law or the EU data privacy law, as kind of a standard or an initial pass that they might try to build on top of, I think they also need to take a look at the practical implications of attempting to protect information. And that's a really difficult thing. You've got the civil liberties issue on one side, but then by the same token, seeing how working with some of my clients overseas, how they're completely handcuffed in some situations at being able to even do things that everyone would agree are wonderful things to do, whether it's respond to a request for information or whether it's to be able to answer a subpoena from the government or something of that nature. I think that there's a lot of information out there already as to how attempting to protect information can sometimes wall it off in a way that is not particularly helpful. So, you know, take a Hippocratic oath. First, do no harm. Make sure that people are protected. But then after that, make sure that you're not hampering both your businesses and your local governments in being able to do the jobs that they want to do simply because someone can put up an invisible force shield of a data privacy law.
Okay, let's go to the ninth topic, which is, I guess it's okay now for me to talk about search and retrieval, Ron, because that's the topic. Sorry, all paths lead to search and retrieval when that's your focus in your business. But that's why I have guests on these shows. It would be real boring with me ranting away. But search and retrieval has been impacted last year by a lot of things. But I think the one that you put on the list, Ron, is a good one. The patentee discovery model order, which limits, among other things, the access to discovery of email to 5 custodians and search terms to 5 terms, sort of presumptively in the beginning before you go into some cost-shifting types of analysis, and should we be exporting this type of thinking to other areas of law? I'll take first crack at this. This model order was created in the Federal Circuit by a subcommittee of judges and lawyers headed by Chief Judge Randall Rader, and there have been cases already that have come out and supported this within the patent area, citing the low volume of email which actually makes its way into court. And you know, while that's no doubt true, the fact of the matter is email does provide a way to keep witnesses honest and build a case. It's secondary evidence in a litigator's quest to find the truth and tell a story through depositions, trying to keep witnesses honest or from forgetting the truth, which happens over the passage of time. And as a former litigator and a search and retrieval expert, I'm frankly horrified at the prospect of searching for the truth with an arbitrarily limited email set and you know, search terms, even if these emails don't ultimately make their way into court. I mean, it starts from the presumption that the other side has a good sense of what they're looking for. And five terms is really limiting, especially if you're playing Go Fish, which is, you know, what you're doing when you're using search terms. My concern about moving this thinking into the other areas of law is, if you look at the composition of this committee, my sense is it was a lawyer-centric group, and I've done an analysis recently that I'm putting in an article on attempts to try to limit search and retrieval. And most of these committees are super committees formed from very bright lawyers who are struggling to deal with these issues, but they don't embrace technologists to come in and have a seat at the table to talk about what different technologies can do. And, you know, I think you need to have both sides of the argument there, because this is a technological problem. So I have a harder time with black letter rule or a hard limit, and I think you got to look at the case and proportionality and reasonableness, but also adopt tools that make your life easier. So that's my rant. Anyone want to add to that?
Kevin, you want to go first?
Kevin, you're a technologist, and you don't always agree with me, so go ahead.
No, but on this particular case, I do agree with you. I mean,
good.
I think that you need to use some tools. You know, one of the battles that we sometimes have when we're called in a case is the battle between the GC and the CFO. And the GC says, we have a case, and we have to keep 3 terabytes worth of data. And the CFO says, that's too expensive because it's going to cost $3 million. Just keep $1 million worth. And we said, great, which $1 million worth of information do you want to keep? You know, which do you want to get rid of? And keep in mind that the stuff that you're throwing away may be the stuff that helps you win your case. The thing it comes down to with everything we're doing in discovery these days is that it is what it is. We have increasing amounts of information. And as I said earlier in the discussion, if you know you've got increasing amounts of information, you have to intelligently look for ways of dealing with it proactively. So either you limit the ways that people create information, or you find better ways of dealing with larger pools of information. Those are really the only two choices that you have. And as you say, these committees that come up and say, only take 5 people or only take 2 people, that scares the hell out of me. Most people want more than those kinds of choices when they're picking the color out for their automobile, let alone deciding, you know, an important case. I think that any sort of arbitrary limits like that are doomed to failure.
And Ron, I don't know if you have anything to add to that one before we move to the 10th one.
Just this, that if you do a lot of this litigation, patent litigation, it's usually, I want to get the file wrapper. So to be concerned about e-discovery in patent litigation strikes me as just kind of wrong. And as for sending it out anyplace else, I've seen one decision that's come out now, or one order that's come out now, that's adopted this without any explanation as to why it did. And that bothers me greatly. And I hope everyone will accept and realize what Kevin and you said, that this is just not the way to go.
Great. The last topic is, I think, one of the best ones here, because this concept of proportionality is all the rage in e-discovery circles right now. And, you know, over the course of the last year, starting with the Duke Conference to the meetings in Dallas in early September, where there's been discussion within the sub-rules committee to amend the federal rules, and putting that long process aside, under what circumstances today should a judge, on a sua sponte basis, direct all parties in a civil action before him or her to show cause why discovery shouldn't be phased or limited or cost shared or shifted? You know, why shouldn't this be fair or reasonable? And what if the judge required parties to be present on the return of the order to show cause to make sure they understood what their attorneys wanted to do in discovery? Ron, I'll let you jump into this one.
I can't tell you that I did it often, but there were occasions when I, on my own, told the parties to come back and see me because of this scope of discovery that they wanted to do. And what invariably happened is the parties worked something out and they never had to see me again on that particular issue. I'm a little concerned about if a judge does that, a judge really makes a client come in, because I as a judge would be concerned that I'm creating some type of difficulty between attorney and client, unless I had a conversation with the attorney before and he said, don't worry about it, we know what this is, or something. On the other hand, there are certainly circumstances when you should be exercising proportionality. Proportionality means a lot of things. We've known about it for years now. And actually, if you want to see a lot of good ways to exercise proportionality, you look at the Manual for Complex Litigation and see all the suggestions in there that are given to judges as to how they could limit the scope of discovery or phase discovery, as you suggested, and the like. So there's a lot of things I think you can do.
And Kevin, I don't know if you have anything, or we want to go into the final thought.
I would just echo what Ron said, and one important thing that he mentioned, and that this is not new. And as I said earlier, sometimes we tend to shut down when we hear computer in the same sentence as some of these other words. So, you know, proportionality is something that we've had as part of our profession for eons, and I think that we just need to learn, you know, better ways of applying it in what we're doing in the electronic world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the last question I've been asking everyone on this show now is right now, December 20, 2011, what do you see as the biggest issue in electronic discovery? Ron, you want to throw out something? I know we just went through 10 issues, but is there one that jumps out at you?
I think privacy is going to be the biggest, to be honest with you. As we go forward, I think that's going to be more and more and more of an issue. Especially, as Kevin mentioned, with the rise of all this new media and the intermingling of what you do at work and what you do at home, and how that's all going to wash itself out in the next few years.
Okay, hard to disagree with that one. How about you, Kevin?
No, I agree. I think privacy is going to be a key issue that we can never lose sight of, especially in the way that, you know, our government works and the way that we work as, you know, Americans. I think it's extremely important to make sure the privacy is always in there. But, you know, Carl, unfortunately, I think the biggest issue is the same issue as when you and I first met and dinosaurs ruled the earth. I think that it's the question of both volume and ubiquitousness. You know, as we continue to have more devices and as we continue to have more things come out of Cupertino that people can buy, I think you're going to have just more data out there, and our clients are going to continue to ask us, how do I take care of all this stuff? And as long as we keep creating data in geometrically increasing amounts, I think you, Ron, and I will have plenty to do.
I agree.
Sounds great. Well, on that note, I'd like to wish both of you happy holidays, and thank you for joining us here on the SI Bites. It's always a pleasure to have guests like you, Kevin, and Ron, to share your knowledge with us here at ESI Bites. And hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jernob, for their continued support of ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com for a complete list of our show. It sounds out phonetically as Easy Bites. Of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Reviewlists, wishing you a nice day.